from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Queena Kim in for Michael Krasny.
The FBI today shut down what it's calling the most sophisticated internet site in the business of selling hard drugs, including heroin, cocaine, and LSD.
They called it the Silk Road. And back in 2013, the FBI arrested a young man named Ross Ulbrich. He was a former Eagle Scout, and officials said he masterminded the billion-dollar deep web marketplace that also illegally sold human organs, poisons, and murder for hire. Journalist Nick Bilton pieced together the secrets of Ross Ulbrich's life in a new book, American Kingpin. That's next on Forum, after the news. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Queena Kim in for Michael Krasny. In 2013, FBI agents arrested a 29-year-old man who sat at his laptop at the Glen Park branch of the San Francisco Public Library. His name was Ross Ulbrich. And to his friends and family, he was a former Eagle Scout from Texas who was trying to make it as an entrepreneur in the Bay. But officials claim that Ulbrich was also the Dread Pirate Roberts, the anonymous mastermind behind the deep web marketplace known as the Silk Road. It's a site where people could buy and sell drugs, firearms, and other illegal items. People also sold kidneys and poisons like cyanide. The site brought in over $1 billion. And so who was Ross Ulbrich? And how did this young man turn into someone being pursued by the FBI agents and who spent money on multiple murders for hire? Well, Nick Bilton is here to answer our questions. He's a special correspondent for Vanity Fair, and he has a new book out, American Kingpin, The Epic Hunt for the Criminal Mastermind Behind the Silk Road. He's joining us from NPR West in Los Angeles. Nick Bilton, welcome to Forum.
Thanks for having me.
So I just explained the Silk Road and Ross Ulbrich from the law enforcement point of view. And in your book, you suggest that Ulbrich is sort of this archetype for, is a very familiar archetype for us here in this Bay Area, and that is the archetype of the tech entrepreneur. So I wanted to try something with you. Can you describe the Silk Road to me from Ulbrich's point of view? Like, what do you imagine his elevator pitch might have been? And in Silicon Valley fashion, it wasn't just about business. He was also trying to change the world.
Well, it was definitely much more about trying to change the world than anything. you know, Ulbrich was as you said, he was a Boy Scout. He was an incredibly altruistic kid. He was the guy who would stop in the middle of a conversation and run across the street to help an old lady who was stuck in a traffic light or something like that. He went off to Penn State to study physics. And he could have gone on to be some great physicist. But what happened was at Penn State, he got really interested in libertarian politics. And for the listeners out there that aren't completely familiar with it, this is essentially the political philosophy that most of the tech entrepreneurs in the Valley have. You know, Peter Thiel, Travis Kalanick, who runs Uber, even Steve Jobs was very interested in this. And it's this philosophy that the government should not be able to tell people what they can and can't do, and that the market should decide. And so Ross Ulbrich had this belief that that the Silk Road, this website he created, could be an example of how to legalize drugs, to show that by legalizing drugs, you would have less violence and less overdoses and so on. And so he built the site as an experiment, and it very quickly, as most tech businesses do, it exploded and people started using it en masse. And next thing you know, he's, as you said, he's making hundreds of millions of dollars and having to put out hits on people.
So this was a site, in his view, that didn't just sell anything you wanted to buy, but also would sort of change the world in terms of allowing people to take control of their own fate?
Yeah, so one of the things when I was reporting the book, I was able to talk to people who he had gone to school with at Penn State and seen some of the interviews he'd done. And he loved doing these college campus debates with the college Republicans and the college Democrats, and he would, of course, represent the college Libertarians. And one of the debates he did was around drugs and if they should be legal. And he believed, you know, his argument was, well, if you look at alcohol, which is legal, you don't see any gun wars in the streets or people being killed like you do in, you know, cities across America over alcohol. It's sold in stores and that's it. And he went through a series of things that he argued that point for. And he said that, you know, if you were to create a system, a marketplace where people could buy and sell anything, that would go away too, that these drug wars in Chicago and things would disappear. And in addition, he also believed that the government just doesn't have a right to tell you what you can and cannot put in your body. And so from the perspective of Ross starting the site, it actually made sense on paper. And I think what happened was that, as with all these technologies, things kind of started to spiral out of control very quickly. And he was unable to see how the site was affecting so many people and even resulting in overdoses and things like that.
And let's back up a little bit here. We said that this site was on the deep web. It's not just like you could punch in www.silkroad and get there. How did people get to this site?
So there's a technology called Tor, which was actually built by the U.S. military for people, Army and Navy overseas, to be able to talk to their family when they're, you know, in Iraq or something like that without having to worry about someone snooping on their email or so on. And what Tor does is it anonymizes everything. It creates essentially an upside-down version of the internet where everything is anonymous and kind of difficult to figure out. The way you would access the website is you would download Tor for free, and then you would go on the dark web and you would type in – it's not like URLs like silkroad.com. It's a series of random numbers and letters, and that would take you to the website. And the way you bought things, and this was the key to this whole process, was we're using Bitcoin, which is essentially a digital cash. And so you could go just like when you're at the airport and you want to exchange your dollars for euros before you go to Europe. You can go online and you can exchange your dollars or anything for Bitcoin, and then you could buy and sell things on the dark web, as you still can today.
So Ulbricht is you've described his ideas, and he's pretty much pursuing these ideas. He's selling drugs on the site, but at some point he makes a transformation. Eventually, Ross Ulbricht, who by all accounts was a really sweet guy, becomes Dread Pirate Roberts, the criminal mastermind. And in my reading of your book, it seems like that transformation and the moral compromises he makes is really tied to growing the site.
Yeah, I think that at the end of the day, Ross was not interested in making money. that was an interest of his, but it was not the, you know, it wasn't the driving factor. I think that the driving factor was that he wanted to put a dent in the universe in the same way that everyone in Silicon Valley wants to do that. They want to change the world. And I think that what happens is in that pursuit, once you get going on it, you see how impactful the thing is that you have made can be. And you don't want anything to get in the way of affecting that. And that's what happened with Ross. And so, you know, at first when he started the site, he needed some what he would call his product to sell on the site. So he rented a small little space in Austin, Texas, and grew his own magic mushrooms. And, you know, one of the funny little asides there was he got really into the show Breaking Bad, and that was right. What he would watch while he was waiting for his mushrooms to grow.
And Breaking Bad, for folks who don't know, is the show where a high school teacher becomes basically a big meth dealer.
Correct.
Sort of like, a really nice guy turning into the criminal mastermind of a drug ring.
Yeah. And so Ross starts selling magic mushrooms and marijuana on the site. And you know, at first there was a couple of people that knew that it was him, and they were very supportive, because I actually completely agree with this. I think that the drug war against marijuana and magic mushrooms and drugs like that is just completely ludicrous. But then things started to, you know, it was an open marketplace and people started to sell heroin. And then it started to be guns and bomb parts and hacker tools and cyanide and all these things. And along that way, you know, Ross didn't want to say, well, you can buy and sell this, but you can't buy and sell that. So it was pretty much a free-for-all. Anybody could do anything. And then what happened was he started to hire employees in the same way you would with a normal startup. And one of the employees he hired was this guy who went by the name Variety Jones. Everyone had a moniker on there. And Variety Jones was the guy who came up with the renaming of Ross to be called the Dread Pirate Roberts, which ended up being one of the biggest things that he influence the site with.
Yeah, and it's a riff off the character in the movie Princess Bride. Tell us about that character and what that has to do with this site, or how that.
So the Princess Bride is the Princess Bride is that cult movie. I think it was actually done by Disney, or Disney owns it now. And the story goes that in this cult movie, which is a fantastic film, anyone should watch it. There's a guy called the Dread Pirate Roberts, and every few years the Dread Pirate Roberts retires and hands off his mask and his outfit to and his name to someone else, and that no one knows who the old Dread Pirate Roberts was and who the new one is. They just kind of continue on, and the goal for Ross and Variety Jones on the Silk Road was to do the same thing, that eventually Ross would retire and hand off the moniker to someone else. And it became a kind of, it was a brilliant concept because it set a tone. It was a kind of a fearful, you know, name. It also kind of created this enigma around how many people were involved in the site. And, you know, there was law enforcement from all over the world trying to hunt him down. And they didn't know, you know, all they knew was that it was this guy called the Dread Pirate, or it could have been a girl, it could have been 100 people, mm-hmm. called the Dread Pirate Roberts, and the site was growing at a rapid pace. That's all they knew.
And so that was an idea that came, that Variety Jones came up with. And would it be fair to say that if Ulbrich was the CEO, Variety Jones was the COO of the Silk Road?
That is correct. Variety Jones was a kind of almost like, you know, Sheryl Sandberg for the Silk Road. He was a mentor. He was the CEO coach, and he was his right hand person. And you know, whenever there was problems on the site, Variety Jones would help come up with solutions. Whenever he believed that Ross was doing something dumb or had a silly strategy, he would point him in a different direction. You know, one of the things that I was able to do with the reporting of the book was get access to literally millions of words of documents and emails and chat logs and photos and all these different things associated with the site and with Ross. And in one of the chat logs at one point, there was a part that stands out to me, which was Ross had wanted to – they were growing the site rapidly, and they wanted to expand, and they wanted to build a Silk Road for pharmaceuticals and a Silk Road for guns and a Silk Road for hacker tools and so on. And Ross, one of the things he wanted to do was build a Spanish-speaking version. And Variety Jones yelled at him and was like, "What are you thinking? That's not going to grow our bottom line." And he said to him in the chat, you know, "Do you want to be known as Larry the Cable Guy or the next Steve Jobs?" And it was just such a perfect line that any CEO coach would have said to their CEO of a startup in the Valley.
Well, I wanted to get to this, but the reporting process, you didn't actually get to talk to Ulbrich. You'd mentioned these chats. Did those come from the court trial? And tell us how, because the book really reads like a novel. It's a narrative. You feel like you're almost reading a fiction book. You get into the head of Ross as well as all the other characters. Tell us a little bit about that reporting process and where you got all your information and that sort of stuff.
So it's interesting. My last book was called Hatching Twitter, and it was about the founding story of Twitter. And one of the things that was most useful in reporting that book was Twitter. You know, I wrote about the folks that started it, and I spent time with them, and I got to interview them all. But the thing that was so fascinating was being able to go back in time through the Twitter timeline, thousands and thousands of posts, tweets and photos and things, and see where they were and what they had done on a certain day and videos they'd uploaded or photos. And it was just a fascinating look at a kind of a new way of reporting narrative nonfiction. With the book American Kingpin on the Silk Road, I knew I wasn't going to get to talk to Ross because he's actually, as you know, not to give away the ending, but he's in jail and he's in an appeal process and doesn't want to talk to anyone. But the thing that's so fascinating is he lived a very private life in public, mm-hmm. but in private he was incredibly public. So for 3 years he literally spoke to every single one of his employees on chat. He, you know, spent most of his waking hours on a computer. So he, as Ross, he was on Facebook and Google Plus and Twitter and all these things, and as the Dread Pirate Roberts he was on the Silk Road. And so there was just this unbelievable amount of content. And so I worked with a researcher and we scoured the web and found comments he'd left or videos he'd shared, photos he'd posted. We went through his entire social media timeline for the past decade. And then we, on the Dread Pirate Robert side, we pulled all the chat logs and diary entries and photos and text messages and emails he'd sent to people. And we put them all in a database, and where we could kind of cross-reference everything by time. So if the Dread Pirate Robert said, I'm going away this weekend to one of his employees and told them to manage the website, if you looked on Ross's Facebook, you would see a photo of him getting ready to go on a camping trip. And you would, he would go on the camping trip for 2 days and take all these photos and share all these comments and thoughts on his trip. And then when you would come back, you would see the Dread Pirate Roberts log back on at the exact same moment that he posted his last post from his trip. And this happened hundreds of times throughout the reporting process. And it was so fascinating to see the amount of detail we could gather from these things.
It's all the things that people warn us about, right? Like that you can sort of really recreate someone's life from all the digital dust that they leave behind. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's fascinating. You know, the thing that was almost terrifying in some respects was there was moments where I found things that you know, a decade ago you would never have been able to do anything with. So, for example, there was one photo on Ross's computer that Ross had taken on a cell phone of a girl named Crystal, and that's all it was one picture and a first name. But there's this secret EXAF data. It's the metadata inside a photograph. It's almost like the back of the photo, and you can see when it was taken and the type of camera was used. And in some instances, you can see GPS locations. And using that GPS location, which was in Portland, we were able to figure out who she was, her phone number, address, and everything in about 4 or 5 minutes.
Wow.
And that was just from a single photo.
So like in any good crime book, there's the plot line of Ulbrich, who's growing Silk Road and it's all going great. But then there's law enforcement on the other side of this equation. And so tell us how the law enforcement first caught on to this Silk Road.
Well, so there was a number of different law enforcement officers from around the world, but majority of around America that were hunting the site. And one of the first investigations to open up was from in Chicago. And another part of the reporting process was I spent, you know, hundreds of hours with all these different officers and learned their story, and even got to go to a lot of the places where the drugs came in and the Chicago O'Hare Airport and things like that. And so the story begins from the law enforcement side. It's June 1st, 2011, and the site has been up for about 6 months. And there's the way that mail comes into the U.S. is a lot of it travels just on a normal plane. And so there was a KLM flight that came in from Amsterdam. And what happens is when we go out the gate and go through customs, all the mail gets pulled out of the belly of the plane and it goes to a mail sorting facility on the airport. And so all this mail came through, and there was this customs agent. And what they do is, I've been to the facilities. It is fascinating. I mean, there was, you know, almost like 5 football fields big.
Wow.
Filled with these tubs of mail. It's amazing to see. And all the mail gets put on these conveyor belts. And these customs agents and these mail facility agents, they use their gut. They just grab the mail. They feel it. They look for clues, like if the mail has been typed instead of written with a pen, if it feels like it's got a bulge in it, you know. And then they set the mail aside as it comes through the conveyor belt that they think looks suspicious, and they open it. And if it's nothing, it gets taped back up and sent. And if it's something, it gets seized. And on this particular morning, this customs agent found a single pink pill of ecstasy. And he had been doing this for a while, and he'd seen drugs coming in through the country, but he'd never seen such a small amount of drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And it led him to call the Department of Homeland Security office in the airport. And this newbie, this new guy, his name is Jared DeYagan, went over there to see it and started to suspect there was something up, because Jared was fully aware that the drugs came into the country. But again, he was like, well, why is someone sending one single pill? And eventually it leads him to someone's front door in Chicago who had ordered some drugs. And the person just opened up and told him everything about it. And that was one of the things that led to the opening of the investigation.
Now, when he first found this out, his superiors were just sort of like, yeah, whatever, you know, it's a one-off.
Well, yeah, I mean, think about it. You've got trillions of dollars of drugs coming in and out of America. And then you've got this new kid on the block who is, you know, essentially going through training. And he says, I want to go and open an investigation on a single solitary pink pill. you know, it's like his investigators thought he was crazy. But what Jared really was worried about was that if you could sell drugs in it now, and that which you could, what about if it was weapons in the future, or if ISIS or Al Qaeda used the site when they came into America to buy illegal things and like weapons, or if some dumb kid, you know, from a high school purchased a gun or something like that. He saw that it was not just about the drugs, but it was about this bigger concept of what the site could do.
So Diagan gets the go-ahead from his boss to pursue this. But in the meantime, there's this whole other motley crew of law enforcement officials pursuing Ulbrich. I guess tell us about one of them. I'm thinking of maybe Carl Force. Yeah.
Yeah, so Diagan opens up the case and he starts doing his thing. And then in Baltimore, there's a DEA agent who is kind of coming to the end of his career, and he's had a pretty sad and pathetic career where he was once a really good undercover DEA agent, but he started to kind of get a little too close to the subjects he was going after, and he would start getting too drunk with them crossing the line, and eventually ends up kind of having a bit of a nervous breakdown and ends up getting a desk job, which he's just going to kind of ride out till the end of his career and then retire and go be an accountant or something like that. And he gets this opportunity to go work on the Silk Road undercover. And he thinks, well, how much trouble can I get in on a computer? Little did he know, he would end up eventually along with a Secret Service agent turning and working for Ross and selling secrets to him and staging murders. And him and the Secret Service guy eventually ended up getting away with almost $2 million in stolen Bitcoin that they had siphoned from the site and gotten from selling information back to the drug pirate Roberts.
Yeah, so it's interesting to me because you really play with this notion, sort of like the John Woo idea of the criminal and the cop are two sides of the same coin. And it feels like online that line becomes even more blurred.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the thing that's so fascinating is that there's two aspects of it. One is, I think on the internet and in these tech companies, people are incapable of seeing how the thing that they have created is affecting other people. You know, I've met people that have been so unbelievably sweet and kind and nice in person, and then I'll go and look at their Twitter feed and I'll go to follow them on Twitter, and there's, you know, saying, oh, Nick Bilton's an X, Y, and Z, and calling me every name in the book. And I think that they don't necessarily put those two things together, you know, and we see this happen all the time, and I think that this is what happened on the Silk Road, too.
We are talking to Nick Bilton. He's a special correspondent for Vanity Fair. He has a new book out called The American Kingpin, The Epic Hunt for the Criminal Mastermind Behind the Silk Road. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. I'm Queenie Kim, sitting in for Michael Krasny, and you are listening to Forum. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Queenie Kim, in for Michael Krasny. We are talking to Nick Bilton. He's a special correspondent for Vanity Fair, and he has a new book out, American Kingpin, The Epic Hunt for the Criminal Mastermind Behind the Silk Road. We're opening up the lines for you to join us in this conversation. If you have any comments or you want to ask Nick Bilton any questions, you can call us at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Or you can email your questions to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. And of course, you can tweet at us, and we are at KQED Forum. So, Nick, you used to live in San Francisco, and I'm curious, and cover tech, how did you get interested in this topic? Was it just that you saw it in the headlines, or how did your interest come about?
That's a great question. So I lived in San Francisco in Glen Park, of all places, and
really?
I used to walk my dog every single day past the coffee shops and the library and the sushi place down there. And I remember I would see this little library that was kind of was so tiny, I used to wonder who goes to that library. And then one day, I was working for the New York Times at the time, and I was covering, I was a columnist, so I was pretty much writing about anything related to tech. So I did cover hackers and some dark web stuff, but never really the Silk Road, but it was fully aware of it. and so one day, the headlines came out that the Dread Pirate Roberts, the guy running the website, Ross Ulbricht, had been arrested in the public library a couple of blocks from my house. And I was just amazed. And I actually went down there and took some photos and ended up writing a column about that. And that kind of led me to pursue the book. And one of the things that was so fascinating to me was that, you know, he was arrested at the library. When I have now done all the reporting and investigation, we used to eat at the same coffee shop. I mean, eat at the same restaurants and drink at the same coffee shops. I could have been sitting next to him, and he was running this empire that was and ordering the hits of people from the same places that I was sitting at, and you would never have known.
Yeah. So law enforcement officials grabbed him at that library. Can you tell us about the peculiar challenge that they had in nabbing this guy? And I'm sort of thinking, yeah, go ahead.
So in addition to, of course, Carl Forrest of the DA and Jared Yeagan of the Department of Homeland Security, there were other people that were, of course, investigating the site. And there was Gary Alford from the IRS who was looking at the financial side of it. There was local and state level police from the drug side. And then there was, of course, the FBI, the Cyber Crimes Division, and an agent called Chris Tarbell. And, you know, through a series of events that are incredibly dramatic and almost terrifying in the book, they eventually finger Ross Ulbricht and they start following him and trailing him, the FBI does. And one of the things that Chris Tarbell, the FBI agent, had learned was that he had arrested someone else for some cybersecurity stuff a couple of years earlier, and they had gone into the person's house with a SWAT team, kicked down the door, thrown some smoke grenades and so on. And the guy they arrested, all he needed to do to ensure that he didn't get in trouble was close his laptop because it was encrypted. And
that meant, for folks who don't know what encrypted means, it sort of means it's sort of in the secret code. You can't break it?
Yeah, if with good encryption, even with the best FBI computers there are today, it could take 1,000 years to break a good encryption password. It's impossible. And so Chris Tarbell understood this. And so when they finally descended on Glen Park at the end of 2013 to arrest Ulbricht, there was a big problem because the FBI supervisor had seen the chat logs and the servers and stuff like that and believed that Ross had people killed. And so he didn't want to risk an agent. He didn't know who this kid was. He didn't know what was going to happen. He didn't want to risk having some agents end up getting killed in the process of arresting him. So they went in with a SWAT team again. And Chris Tarbell was like, absolutely no way, we can't do this. We need to get him with his hands on his laptop. And so this became the big challenge of not only getting him with his hands on his laptop, but also getting him while he was logged into the Silk Road as the site administrator and a variety of other things. And so it's an incredibly tense moment when they're trying to pull that off.
And I guess the idea behind that is because that computer is really the hard evidence. And I think you say in your book, it would sort of be like grabbing a drug dealer and having him flush all his drugs down the toilet. You don't really have any evidence to show that he was a drug dealer or that he has these drugs.
Yeah, you could, you know, Ross's defense, which he did end up employing, was that, you know, there were multiple Dread Pirate Roberts, but he, you know, if he wasn't caught on the computer, they would have had a much harder time convicting him, especially of all the counts that they did convict him with. And so they had to ensure that that they got him logged in. And so, to the end of the story, it all comes together where all the agents working together, including Jared Yeagan, who found the first pink pill, he ends up working undercover on the website. And so they kind of pull off this very dramatic thing to do that. But and at the same time, you have Carl Forrest, who, of course, is trying to hide all of his bad
the
deeds.
The tainted.
DA agent.
Yeah. So we are opening up the phone lines. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions to forum at kqed.org, or you can tweet at us. We are at KQED Forum, and we've got a call here from Victoria from Berkeley. Victoria, go ahead and tell us what you're thinking.
Hey, first I want to say thank you for doing this interview. I think it's really fascinating.
Well, thanks for listening.
I feel a little bit uncomfortable about the way we're talking about this guy. I feel like everything is framed around him being this really good person who cares about people and who wants to change the world. You know, he's like a white guy who's college educated. He's a tech bro in Silicon Valley. And I think we have a way of, like, glorifying those things and giving people free passes. But it seems like he, you know, facilitated the death of many people, as well as drug addiction and, like, enabling this underground, you know, drug world. And I understand that his intention was to reduce violence in the world, but I feel like maybe he didn't do his research. I don't know. I feel like he was kind of
Yeah, careless. That's an interesting question, Victoria. And I think, Nick, you seem to struggle with that notion in the book, too.
No, I completely 1,000% agree with you. One of the things that's happened since the book came out is that there is a contingent of people online, including some of Ross's family members, who have, you know, they haven't read the book, but they have attacked it for a variety of reasons. And one of their arguments is, well, Ross was just trying to, you know, he just ran a website. He was just trying to, you know, trying to make the world a better place. But one of the things where what really frustrates me about that is that he essentially tried to use the argument that he was different than someone else because he did it all from behind a computer. And the judge in the case, in the sentencing, said that, you know, that was an argument of privilege and that quote unquote, you know, nobody from the Bronx who is forced to buy and sell drugs because, you know, to raise their family or whatever it is that they have, the reasons they end up doing it, no one from the Bronx would make that argument. And I think she found that really, really almost disgusting, that was the defense. And I think that for me, the thing that was so frustrating was that he was unable to see how the site he was running was doing the thing he had set out to do, but it was doing so many bad things at the same time. And you can see this as a chapter in the book where Ross goes camping for a weekend. And on that same weekend, there's a kid in Perth who gets access to some bad drugs from China that were made in a lab that he would never have been able to get access on, before the Silk Road. And he overdoses and jumps off a balcony and dies. And I think that, you know, when you kind of juxtapose those things about how he thinks he's changing the world and how there are people whose lives are being affected drastically by this, it is pretty frustrating to see the response by some of the people that support him.
I'm curious, and I'm not sure if I'm able to articulate this, so I'll just say it sort of broadly. Do you think there's a cautionary sort of tale here, or sort of almost a parable of what's happening in Silicon Valley right now, in that there's this greater good that everybody's achieving, but in pursuit of that good, sometimes it's okay to sort of skirt the line? And we've been seeing this a lot in Silicon Valley right now.
Without question. I mean, I was amazed when I was reporting the story at just how many similarities there were, not only with, you know, with Ross Ulbricht and the folks in the Silicon Valley, but with how people set out to do something with technology with the hope of something good coming from it. And they don't think about the negatives. So, for example, you know, I was in the room with the folks who first built some of the 3D printers that are out there today. And I remember saying to them, oh, wow, what are people going to use this for? It's really fascinating. And they said, oh, you know, people will make their own iPhone cases and wall hooks and you know, little trinkets to put on their desk. And, of course, the first thing that came out of 3D printers was 3D printing plastic guns. And it never entered their mind, and I understand that certain people can't think about evil things like that, but I think that we have a responsibility. And you see the same thing, you know, Facebook put out the news feed so people could connect with their friends and see who had a baby or what cappuccino someone just drank. And then, of course, Russia uses it to share fake news and possibly sway the election. You know, Twitter was designed to be able to allow people to share, like, which club they were going to and their little thoughts at any moment and point in time. And it's become one of the hotbeds for trolls and essential just attacking people on the internet without any kind of recourse. And I think that
and we're
Ross
seeing
set out
about Uber here, right, with Travis
Kalanick.
Yeah,
Uber, completely. They set out, they believed that the taxi industry was broken and they were completely right and that regulation had hurt consumers. And then they get to a point where they start doing exactly what they tried to fight against, and I think at the end of the day, what is most terrifying from me for after seeing the Silk Road story and all these other companies is that we're technology, sure, it has invaded every moment of our life, but it hasn't taken over yet. We're not in driverless cars. We don't rely on a robot to clean our house or make our breakfast or walk our kid to school. But eventually we will get to that point, and there's going to be really, really bad sides to those technologies. And I think we have a responsibility to think about what those are before we build them.
And whose responsibility is that? Tech companies, the entrepreneurs,
absolutely,
the government?
I mean, look, these tech companies make billions and billions and billions of dollars a year in profits. Why doesn't Google or Facebook have a team of ethics folks that look at what every single thing they build could be used negatively,
or fact checkers,
or fact checkers? Yeah, it's just not important to them. Google did. They purchased an artificial intelligence company a couple of years ago, DeepMind, and they do have an ethics board that has to kind of try to think about how these artificial intelligence technologies they're building could spin out of control or something like that. But they should be doing this with every single solitary thing that they touch. And I just don't understand why they don't do that. It seems like it would not be that big of an expense. In the same way that the FBI and places like that work with hackers to figure out how to avoid new hacks. These big tech companies should be employing people, both good and bad, to try to think about how their technologies could be used evilly.
We are talking to Nick Bilton. He's a special correspondent for Vanity Fair, and he has a new book out called American Kingpin, the epic hunt for the criminal mastermind behind the Silk Road. We are taking your calls. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions to us at forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. And we do have a call here. It's from Kevin in San Francisco. And Kevin, welcome to Forum.
Hi there, Nick. I had a couple comments to make because I haven't heard you mention either of these facts yet. But I followed the trial as it was happening. And one of the things I noticed was the FBI agents that were investigating this, two of them were charged with stealing money from Silk Road. That was not mentioned during the trial. I was not allowed to be mentioned. The other thing was that he was never charged with arranging any murders, which was the most serious aspect of all of this. And it was mentioned to the jurors in the trial, but he was never formally charged with this. And I guess this leads me to a question: that was he actually the one and only Dread Pirate Roberts? I'd like to hear your response to that.
So there is not a inkling of a single solitary doubt in my mind that he was the only Dread Pirate Roberts. When you look at the literally millions of words of chat logs and the things that are written in those chat logs and how they correspond with Ross's social media platforms and emails and so on, it would have taken a team of thousands of people to manipulate that data. It is down to the millisecond. It all lines up. For example, even when he was arrested, logged in to the Mastermind website of the Silk Road, which was where all the money was. He was logged in as the Dread Pirate Roberts on the forums and all on the website. He had on his diary on his computer, he talked about how he had gotten poison ivy when he was in the woods near his house. He'd emailed his girlfriend from his personal email account about that. He had told the police officer, the FBI agent, when he was arrested about that. These are all there are quite literally hundreds of these moments when he goes to Dominica to try to get a green card, citizenship there so he can hide out there if he needs to. He literally logs off the site and tells his employee he's going to be on a six-hour flight as he gets on the six-hour flight, which I have a record of. And so to manipulate these things, I think, would have taken a small army of people, and Ross would have known something was up in leading up to that. At the trial, he even admitted that he started the Silk Road because one of the people he had employed, who was a friend of his to help him program it, had testified against him. And so in my reporting and my research, when I first set out to do this, I did not know if he was the only one. At the end of this, there's not a question in my mind. To go back to the other points.
The murder charges.
The murder charges. So this comes up a lot from people who don't believe that Ross should be in jail. And he actually was charged with murder. It was never prosecuted. It was charged in Baltimore, and the Baltimore never prosecuted for a couple of reasons, one being that New York had decided to prosecute the case first. As far as it being about him, it being referenced in the trial, he was actually charged with something more severe than murder. It was called the Kingpin Statute, and there have been only a handful of people who have been charged with that in the U.S. history, including people like John Gotti and so on. And the Kingpin Statute is essentially encompasses everything. It encompasses money laundering and employing more than five people who work for you that do things that are illegal, whether it's selling drugs or whatever. And so the prosecution from the Southern District in New York that charged it, they referenced the murders, even though they were never formally charged as murders, because they were part of the Kingpin Statute. And the thing that I always find kind of perplexing is that you know, as people, when they read the book, see that the murders didn't happen. One of them was done by that bad DEA agent who had faked it, and the others, there were never any bodies, and they believe it was just a scam. But people say, well, okay, well, there was no body, so Ross didn't do anything wrong. But if a conspiracy to commit murder is a federal offense that you could be put in jail for the rest of your life, and people seem to think just because he did it from behind a computer and nothing happened, that it's not something that he should get in trouble for. And I just find that's perplexing to me.
We have a comment here from Mary, and we sort of flicked at this, but it seems worth asking directly. What does this story say about the libertarian philosophy? And are we starting to see the limits of this? And do you see – I know you're not in San Francisco anymore, but are you starting
to see – No, I'm up there a lot for work.
But, yeah, folks, yep, starting to rethink this or starting to give it a little bit more of a critical look?
Well, I think that there are groups of people in the Valley that think it's a little bit of a justification, and there are people that think that it's an important argument. You know, there are a lot of people like Peter Thiel, for example, who look at the libertarian philosophy and think, okay, well, certain things are going to break in the process and people will be affected and hurt. But at the end of the day, the system we have today doesn't work, and this is one way of breaking it. What I feel from my reporting is that, and even, one of the most fascinating parts of the reporting for me was when I got to speak to people who had been part of the libertarian club that Ross was in when he was in Penn State. And a lot of them, you know, say the same thing that we all would say today, like, oh, well, it was just this kind of this philosophy that I was interested in college. But now that I think about it, it doesn't necessarily make a lot of sense. And one of the, you know, when you get really, really deep into this libertarian politics and philosophy, it's very removed in respect of, it says that anyone should be allowed to do anything that they want with their body or the time or whatever it is with their life, and that no one should interfere with that. But it doesn't think about the fact of what happens if the thing that they do affects someone else in a very negative and drastic way. And so if someone overdoses from a drug that they take, the philosophy is, well, that was their choice. But what about their families and things like that? And if you follow it down this path, I think that there's a lot of hypocrisies behind it. There are a lot of parts of it that make a lot of sense, but I think it's just as flawed as any other political philosophy.
Yeah, anything that's really theoretical. You're listening to Forum. We are talking to Nick Bilton. He's a special correspondent for Vanity Fair. He has a new book out, American Kingpin, The Epic Hunt for the Criminal Mastermind Behind the Silk Road. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information on how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Queen Akim. Let's go back to some of your calls and comments. We've got a call here from Arlene in Berkeley. And Arlene, welcome to Forum.
Hi, thank you. I have a question about what you would do, the one thing to help stop this kind of behavior. And what would that be? Like, I was actually coming off BART there at Glen Park when all this was going on.
You actually saw it go down?
Yeah, I saw like them. I saw like things happening. You know, I didn't see them come out or anything, but you know, I saw that. I walked around the other way around the block when it looked scary, and that's like a place where families gather. You know, there's a little cafe on the corner. Tiger, been there for maybe 30 years or something. You know, there's all these little coffee shops. It's a library. You bring the children there all the time for getting passes to the museum, seeing books. Yeah. I mean, it's a family place.
And so what's your question?
So like, the question is, what would he do to stop this from happening? One thing that would, can he think of that could help?
Let's ask Nick that question. Nick, I mean, we've sort of been circling around this question a couple times. I'm wondering if there's anything you want to more to add in terms of it seems like, you know, the bloom is sort of off this tech, you know, sort of the high of Silicon Valley, and some of people are starting to sort of see the rougher edges around it. Have you been giving any thought about how do we who's responsible? How do we hold folks accountable? Where does this start?
Well, I think as far as the war on drugs goes, the one thing I will definitely agree with all the raw supporters on is the war on drugs has not worked. His approach didn't work either. But, you know, that is something that that people need to rethink. And it's definitely not going to happen under this administration. But it could happen in the future and probably should. I think that it's pretty ludicrous the laws that exist for people that sell mild drugs like marijuana and things like that. As far as the tech side of things, I think that there is this philosophy in the Valley and in tech that we're here just to make the world a better place. And I think it's complete and utter nonsense. These are people who not only want to get rich, but they want to be famous. They want to be remembered for inventing something or doing something that had an impact. That was that was Ross's philosophy. He wanted to be remembered as the guy who legalized drugs and changed the world, and was willing to do anything to get there. And I think you see the same thing with people like Travis from Uber and you know, the leaders of Twitter and Facebook and all these companies. And I think that philosophy should just be thrown in the garbage because it's complete nonsense. They're not just here to make the world a better place. Most of the people in the Valley are either there to get rich or there to be remembered as a great person, as the next Steve Jobs. And I think that if they kind of employed that a little bit more, and just like, you know, Wall Street doesn't pretend that they're trying to make the world a better place, I think that there's a world in which we could talk more openly about the things that go wrong and try to be more prepared for them when they do happen.
We have a comment through tweet. JD tweets, would you consider that our justice system is playing catch up in knowing how to pursue and prosecute cyber crimes like the Silk Road?
Without a doubt, I think that not only is the Justice Department playing catch up, but the government is 10 steps behind on all of this stuff. And the speed with which technology can be made today and grow it's only gonna get faster and faster. And like if you look at Instagram, which sold 5 years ago for $1 billion to Facebook, it had 12 employees, 13 if you count the intern. And that's amazing of how fast, you know, Snapchat started 4.5 years ago in a Stanford dorm room and is now a $20+ billion company with hundreds of millions of people that use it. And that's the same thing that happens with the bad side of technology, the stuff on the dark web and hackers and so on and so forth. And I think that the government really needs to kind of get its head together and try to figure out how to be further ahead of these things. But I really don't think it's going to happen. I think when you look at the Senate and the House and all and the White House, they're not people that are thinking about that. They're thinking about things from the past.
Yeah, there's that great scene in your book where DeYagan is with some other folks who want to get in on the action from Department of Homeland Security. And they're like, yeah, we're going to nab this guy in a couple weeks. Don't worry.
And DeYagan's like, what are you talking about? You have no idea what you're up against. This is not just going to a street corner and arresting someone selling drugs. And the other part that's fascinating is, you know, as they're doing the investigation, of course, with investigations, you're always looking at different suspects, but they have no idea at first who it is. They think at one point that it's maybe the Mexican cartels or Russian hackers or, you know, some Chinese underground folks, or at one point it's a Google employee, they think, or this guy who runs a Bitcoin server, and they have no idea. And finally, when they figure out that it's Ross, through all these clues that kind of pile up atop each other, there's this moment like when they look at his Facebook page, and it's pictures of him hugging his mom and laying there with a little poodle and stuff and a little dog, and he and they're like, this is the guy that we've been hunting for the past 2.5 years, and it's amazing.
Well, that's it for this hour of Forum. We've been talking to Nick Bilton. He is special correspondent for Vanity Fair. He has a new book out called American Kingpin, the epic hunt for the criminal mastermind behind the Silk Road. Thanks so much for coming onto the show, Nick.
Thank you for having me.
And I'm Queen of Kim, in for Michael Krasny. You are listening to Forum, and thanks so much for joining us on this hour.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.